TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Mr. George Galloway comes to San Francisco. Mission High School auditorium was packed in anticipation of one of the great orators of our time. George Galloway had been a member of the British Labour Party for 36 years when he was expelled in October 2003 for his opposition to the war on Iraq. In May of 2005, he had one of the most amazing upset victories in electoral history. Standing for the Respect Party and campaigning passionately for an immediate end of the war on Iraq, he returned to Parliament as the representative for the East London Bethnal Green and Bow District. Here's part one of a two-part broadcast of George Galloway in San Francisco, beginning with a standing ovation.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Wow. Thank you very much, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends. Wassalamu alaikum. Peace be with every one of you. And thank you to the city of San Francisco for their official welcome. But your unofficial welcome is even more welcome for me. And I want to start out by telling you what I'm not going to talk about before I tell you what I am. Especially because my name is George, I'm not going to try and recolonize the United States of America. I'm declining all invitations, and I've had many, believe me, to renounce my British citizenship and take up citizenship of the United States and run for office. But when I look at the governor of California, when I look at Arnold Schwarzenegger, I don't think we should take the risk of changing the Constitution here in the United States of America. But I will be back, and again and again, if you'll have me, because I put it this way: if our two countries can be the biggest rogue states in the world, stand shoulder to shoulder with each other, then those of us in those two countries who stand against our leaders must stand shoulder to shoulder with each other across the ocean and across the time zones. And anyway, I've always hated imperialism. I come from an Irish background. One day I came home and told my Irish grandfather that the teacher had said that the British had an empire so vast that upon it the sun never set. And my grandfather answered, "That's because God would never trust the English in the dark." And I never had any reason to doubt him. The second thing I'm not going to be doing here this evening is parading any kind of anti-Americanism. I'm accused on a daily, almost hourly basis by the crazed neocons who seem to inhabit your airwaves, including a madman today, Ron, what was his second name? Ron Owens, my God. I thought I'd stumble into Fox by mistake. I thought it was Bill O'Reilly I'd come before. They accuse me of a visceral anti-Americanism. Let me let you in on a secret. I'm the great-grandson of probably the only woman in the 19th century who emigrated from America to Scotland at a time when thousands were sailing in the opposite direction. So there's nothing anti-American about me or about anybody in the anti-war movement. We want a special relationship with the people of the United States, even though, as Oscar Wilde said, we were two people divided by a common language. And the third thing I'm not going to be doing here tonight is speaking against the troops. There are some crazed junior neocons following me around wearing T-shirts that say, "We love the troops." Well, we love the troops too. That's why we don't want any more of them to be killed or to kill for George Bush and Tony Blair and the pack of lies that they represent. And the fourth thing I'm not going to be saying here this evening is anything in support of the mass murderers of Al-Qaeda, of Bin Laden, of the killers of 9/11, or of 7/7, or of Madrid. We say to the right wing in this country, Bin Laden has nothing to do with us. It was you who invented Bin Laden and the Taliban and the so-called Mujahideen. It was you. You know, I said on the eve of the fall of Kabul to Bin Laden and the fathers of the Taliban, the so-called holy warriors in Afghanistan, I said to Mrs. Thatcher in Parliament, "You have opened the gates for the barbarians, and a long dark night will now descend upon the people of Afghanistan." And what's happened? We punished the Afghan people by sending them Bin Laden, and then we punished them all over again for having been occupied by Bin Laden in the first place. And I say, as I said in Parliament 4 days after 9/11, when we heard Mrs. Bush and Mrs. Bush Jr., I'm going to come back to Mrs. Bush Sr. later on, Mrs. Bush Jr. and Mrs. Blair, in a kind of synchronized swimming in the grief that followed 9/11, when they invited us never to forget those heartbreaking messages of farewell, those heartbreaking messages of love left by those American women from their mobile telephones on the answering machines of their loved ones from aboard those aeroplanes, as if we could ever forget. But just because Afghan women don't have mobile telephones and their loved ones don't have answering machines, it doesn't make their deaths any less obscene than the deaths of those American women on board those aeroplanes. People asked me after that debate, "Well, what would you do to deal with this menace of Islamist fundamentalist terrorism?" And I said this: you may think that these aeroplanes that struck the Twin Towers came out of a clear blue sky, but I believe that they emerged from a swamp of hatred and bitterness and enmity against us, constantly watered by our policies of injustice against the Muslim people of the world. And this is a truth that simply must be grasped. And people say, "Well, what would you do? Do you want to negotiate with these mass murderers?" I say, no, you can't negotiate with Bin Laden. We have to negotiate with those Muslims who haven't joined him yet, but who might join him tomorrow if we continue the policies of injustice around the world. These are the people with whom we must negotiate. And how do we do it? A friend of mine who's doing my timekeeping, Ron Mackay, he and I met in 1977, nearly 30 years ago, in two adjoining Palestinian refugee camps, Sabra and Shatila. Last week was the 23rd anniversary of the massacre of Sabra and Shatila. Many people in America and in Britain didn't even notice the anniversary. Many never even heard or want to hear about the massacre of Sabra and Shatila. Let me remind you what happened there. The Palestinian fighters had left Beirut by international agreement brokered by the United States of America with a guarantee signed by the United States ambassador that the families they left behind in the refugee camps, their wives, their children, their elderly parents, would be protected from harm by the so-called international community. And no sooner had the ships bearing the Palestinian fighters left the harbor when thousands of Israeli soldiers and their Lebanese fascist allies descended like wolves upon the defenseless refugees of these camps and massacred thousands of them, their bodies lying bloated in the sun for many days thereafter, a sight which was to become familiar elsewhere later. Now, who was in charge of that massacre? General Ariel Sharon was actually, literally standing at the gate of those camps. He was in charge of the floodlighting of those camps so that the butchers of Beirut could go about their killing spree. The same Ariel Sharon who was welcomed with a red carpet last week in New York when he attended the United Nations, and we were invited to welcome and honor and be grateful to Ariel Sharon because he gave $250,000 of your money each to 7,000 settlers who had been living on stolen land for almost 40 years. We were asked to be grateful to the Sharon that George Bush described as a man of peace. Even Sharon doesn't describe himself as a man of peace, but George W. Bush thinks he's a man of peace. Now, Ron Mackay and I visited 4 years ago another camp called Jenin. It was still smoldering from another massacre where another large number of Palestinian refugees, supposedly protected by the so-called international community, were massacred. This time, General Sharon was not the defense minister. He was the prime minister in charge of the massacre of Jenin. We walked, and by the way, to the heckler, there's something unique about Jenin you should know. Jenin is the only refugee camp where the Palestinian refugees have lived for 50 years, where if they climb up on the roofs of their houses, they can see the shining city of Haifa, which was their city. They can see their own houses from their refugee camp being lived in by foreigners from Toronto and Brooklyn and London and Paris. They can see their own trees being picked by foreigners while they live in a rancid, rat-infested hovel which was then invaded by Sharon's soldiers and its inhabitants massacred. And the Security Council uniquely met on a Saturday night unanimously for a change. This time the US could not withstand the international wave of revulsion and veto the resolution. The Security Council passed a resolution demanding that Sharon allow United Nations inspectors to enter the camp in Jenin to check on reports of mass destruction amongst the Palestinian refugee population. And Sharon answered them on the Sunday morning. He said, "There will be no United Nations inspectors entering this camp or entering the occupied territories." He told them to get stuffed. And you know what? They promptly got stuffed. They packed their suitcases and went home and never said another word about it again. And this double standard, whereby Iraq was broken on the wheel of sanctions and war, on what grounds? On the grounds of the unacceptability of acquiring other people's territory by force. On the grounds that United Nations Security Council resolutions must be upheld and implemented. On the grounds that no country may seek weapons of mass destruction. Yet there is no country in the world which has broken more United Nations resolutions than Sharon's Israel. There is no country in the world which has acquired more territory from other people by force and held on to it for longer than Sharon's Israel. And as we know, thanks to the brave Jewish whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu, Israel is sitting on a mountain of weapons of mass destruction, including hundreds of nuclear weapons and the missiles to deliver them. Israel is not punished for these, but rewarded endlessly by the United States taxpayer and the United States defense industries, which ensures that every bullet in the back of a Palestinian child in the Gaza Strip is paid for by you and manufactured by you. Every helicopter gunship which swoops out of the sky to fire rockets at the refugees is paid for by you and delivered by your government. And isn't it one of the great ironies that the weapons they're using in Palestine and Iraq have names like Tomahawk and Apache, names redolent of the Native American people who themselves were subject to genocidal mass murder by settlers here in your own country. And the second reason why that swamp of hatred is so deep appears equally difficult for the United States and Britain to grasp. And it is the policy of propping up every puppet president and corrupt king who rules the Muslim world almost without exception from one end to the other. And because of that, the Muslims don't know whether to laugh or cry when they hear Bush and Blair talking about democracy and human rights. They saw the funeral of King Fahd, a tyrant, thief, who turned his country into a personal bank account, which he looted for decades, spending the proceeds in the bordellos and the casinos and the arms bazaars and the stock markets and the banks of Western countries like yours and mine. The Saudi dictatorship has $6 trillion, trillion, in the American banks and the American stock exchange alone. And the reason why these Western leaders went there to bury the tyrant, to kiss the nose as a prelude of kissing somewhere else of his successor, was to ensure that the dictatorship continues to govern Saudi Arabia, not in the interests of its own people, or of the Arab people, or of the Muslim people, but in the interests of the Bush family, the Carlyle Group, and all those other parasites who are feeding off the wealth of the people of the Muslim world. There are many other examples I could give. If I had time, I could talk to you about Hosni Mubarak, who's just been elected in what he told us was the first ever free presidential election in Egypt, which was quite an admission, as he'd been elected president 4 times before. But you know, something funny happened on the way to the polls, which hardly anybody seems to have noticed. Mubarak got more votes in the so-called free election last month than he got in the rigged election 6 years before. He got 84.6% of the vote in the rigged election and 88.4% of the vote in the free election. Go figure. The Egyptians know that this is a farce, that the United States doesn't want free elections in Arabia or in Egypt, because the first thing that any free government in Arabia or Egypt would do would be to kick out the American military bases, close the Israeli embassy, and begin to govern their country in the interests of their own people. I'll give you just one more. Do you remember the general? Do you remember Mr. Bush before he was elected, or rather selected, as president first time out? He was interviewed by a plucky reporter who wouldn't get near him today. Do you remember he asked him for the names of the international leaders that Mr. Bush would have to deal with if he was elected? The reporter asked him, "Do you know who's the leader of Pakistan?" Bush grinned and said, "Sure, the general." And the reporter said, "Well, can you be a bit more specific? Maybe a name or something." And Bush thought for a moment or five and said, "We just call him the general." Well, of course, he was just the general then, a man who had come to power in a military coup, who was suspended from the British Commonwealth, placed under an arms embargo. He was just the general then. But the day after 9/11, he became not the general, but the president. He became the president who was welcomed to develop nuclear weapons. He became the president who was given all the money and all the arms and all the support that he required, not because he was representing the wishes of the people of Pakistan, but because he was representing the wishes of George W. Bush. And what do you think the people in Pakistan or Egypt or Saudi Arabia feel when they hear Bush talking about democracy in the Muslim world? I tell you, they feel bitter and angry, and we fill again that swamp out of which these monstrous mosquitoes came on 9/11, on 7/7, and on so many other occasions. And the third and most serious of all of the contributory factors to this swamp are the monstrous crime that was committed by you and us against the people of Iraq. At every 6 minutes of every day and night, year after year, for more than a decade, we killed 1 million Iraqi children and called it an embargo. The late Pope John Paul II called it the slaughter of the innocents. The Democratic whip on the Hill, David Bonnier of Michigan, called it infanticide masquerading as politics. Very few people in the West cared about those little Iraqi children being laid in the biggest mass grave of them all. But every Muslim in the world cared about it. Every Muslim in the world knows about it. And it's another big reason why so many hundreds of millions of people grew to hate us so intensely that many were ready to hurt us, exchanging their lives for many of ours.
That was the first part of a 50-minute speech by the British Member of Parliament, George Galloway. Come back for part two, where Galloway lists the lies and the liars who led to the war on Iraq. As a member of the British Labour Party that expelled him in 2003 for his opposition to the war on Iraq, Galloway had led a multi-year campaign against the sanctions on Iraq and met twice with Saddam Hussein. This incurred the wrath of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. They accused him of taking kickbacks. In his testimony before the Senate Committee in May of 2005, Galloway turned the table on his accusers, reminding them that U.S. corporations, such as Halliburton, took kickbacks, while he, Galloway, had audited records to show that he did nothing of the sort. You can find out more about George Galloway on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of George Galloway's speech by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is our only support and is essential for keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.